Recording from Hong Kong, where sheep and goats both go to hell, it's Dystopian Present, with your host, Ross, and I'm joined by Alice and...
Rachel.
I remembered. Damn. We're going to do a little bit of post-CNY wrap-up, including what we all did over the Chinese New Year holiday and what you should do, do's and don'ts, if you will. Do a little bit of the Chinese New Year Hong Kong film wrap-up, or a meta-wrap-up, because none of us actually got around to seeing any of the films, and talk a little bit about what we've been reading, watching, contemplating, ingesting, in that order. So, let's kick off with CNY, and let's kick off specifically with the whole sheep and goats thing.
CY Long, CNY.
So the chief executive, which, you know, again, is the guy who's nominally in charge of the place.
Misidentified by the New York Times as somehow equivalent of the mayor.
Mm. Okay.
Really doesn't work that way.
All right. In that he is less powerful than a mayor?
In that it's, I think his kind of purview, A, is executive, and B,
chief.
And chief, be chief. But also that it's not actually a kind of civic purview, it's the SAR, the Special Autonomous Region.
Right.
And
the Special, Administrative Region.
Okay. I've just declared Hong Kong...
Equivalent to Xinjiang or
Ningxia. Inner Mongolia?
Inner Mongolia. Tibet.
But
free Hong Kong! So, Si Walang, not the mayor.
Not the mayor.
The chief executive.
And he has been making headlines in a kind of portmanteau way. People have been picking up on... what's now quite a string of kind of multilingual malapropisms.
Poorly judged comments.
Indeed. And
the essence of which for the viewers at home?
Well, the special one for Chinese New Year, which, as we have discussed in earlier episodes of this podcast, there's a linguistic ambiguity between sheep and goats. There's only one
word.
General word for ruminant, which receives various modifiers, but unlike many historical lexicographers who have been weighing in on this and weighing in on the side of the goats, C.Y. Lung was definitively weighing in on the side of the sheep, urging the people of Hong Kong to
be sheep-like,
be like sheep, and to be, you know, well-behaved. Placid.
Harmonious, I think.
Harmonious.
Harmonious is a real buzzword.
Mm. Right.
But I think, you know, I think we should think of the people of Hong Kong as like goats, as unruly, promiscuous, and omnivorous.
Right. That's what they're carving on my tombstone. But, so as we said, it is essentially the same word, although, as you point out, ruminant. Are there any other ruminants? I mean, can we chuck in...
Cows.
But there's a word for cow.
But I think quite a few kind of portly antelope. I mean, the other things are ruminant.
Okay.
But I think you also have to be horned. I think that's where the ram comes in.
Okay, so yeah. Right. So while so this being the year of the sheep, the one or slash goat, one, the one of the 12
ram. I mean,
or the, well, yeah, ram. Or the ewe. It'll be a little bit gender, you know, neutral.
Yes, and I have seen that pun used in advertising. But I am waiting for the year...
This one's for you?
I'm waiting for the year of the pig, so they can do days of swine and roses.
Ba-da-bump.
Before swine at Mikimoto.
Okay.
So that is actually one of the signs of the Chinese New Year is...
Figuring out how to incorporate the characteristics of the animal.
Into your tie-ins, your commercial tie-ins.
Yeah.
Your marketing plan.
Got it. So, pop quiz. There's sheep, there's dragon, there's snake.
Tiger.
Rat.
Pig.
Ox. Or cow.
That one's always ox.
We said dragon. Dragon's the only unreal creature, right?
What, you believe in rabbits?
Rabbits, okay, good, good.
Another one?
Did we do rat already?
Yes, yeah. We did.
There's got to be a bird of some sort.
There's a rooster.
There's a rooster, that's right.
Rooster? Okay.
That's right. And it is very specifically a rooster, right? No one runs around saying happy chicken here.
Well, we know why that is now.
Okay.
Thanks to this long-running Hong Kong New Year franchise, which is usually...
Mm-hmm.
However many chickens, which, as you've been explaining...
Okay,
slang for a certain something.
Got it. Okay. All right, so let's segue it up. So one of the things, and we'll get on to the do's and don'ts of Chinese New Year's in a minute, but one of the central things that happens in Chinese New Year is it's the equivalent of the Christmas movie time rush. So there's
the Thanksgiving movie time.
Right. Okay. So it is like the time when a few key movies, the key movies of the Hong Kong film industry, are put forward during the year. Yes. No.
Well, I don't know. I actually don't know whether they're the key movies or whether they're movies which are expected to have a big take in this moment.
Okay.
Because they seem to be very fixed in the genres they present, and generally either action-oriented or very upbeat, and I think
sounds more summer blockbustery than the sort of Christmas prestige film that you'll sometimes get.
Yeah, this is not the season for that, and in fact, they have a little bit of difficulty slotting the Oscar-nominated films in, especially this year, when all of this is coming together.
Yes.
Last year, actually, they managed to kind of do more short runs of the Oscar films, and this year there's this kind of tide of
so Hong Kong
swamping The Imitation Game and vice versa.
Right, so they have to kind of make the Hong Kong film industry has to make space for the U.S. Oscar colossus.
Well, I think they generally sort of run that through the theaters that play either multi-language or English language films. But actually, the kind of big impact on the schedule is the Chinese New Year films, which play in places that normally have more diversified bills.
Right. Right. So this year there was one called Little Big Master, which was this sort of treacly sort of child in a rural Chinese school setting. You know, sort of the typical sort of feel-good movie about a child who sort of punches
in a Chinese rural school
setting. Right, who punches through, you know, thousands of years of Confucian led pedagogy.
To bring a smile to your heart.
Yes. Yes.
Did you see this movie?
No.
I didn't
her heart is smiling now.
Okay,
just thinking about it. So that was like on the way end of the feel good spectrum. And then there was From Vegas to Macau 2, which I think is sort of, in some ways I haven't seen it, but I've read a bunch of reviews and kind of sucked up all the clippage I could, and it seems that it typifies a new trend, maybe because of the squeeze that the Hong Kong film industry is in, be it from Oscars, be it from its own kind of shrinking demographics and the coming of the Chinese film industry, where you have to kind of chuck in as much as you can. So even the title says it, like there are set pieces in Vegas and Macau, and as you pointed out before we aired, there's also a long set piece in Thailand, which I think is only there because it was cheaper to blow up shit there. So,
if indeed it's really Thailand and they're not blowing this stuff up in a place that's made up to look like Thailand.
Right. So
basically, it's the kind of thing where you don't just chuck the kitchen sink in, you put a big outboard motor on the back of the kitchen sink, and you drive it through the delta.
Right.
Like the rescuer.
Yeah. So as far as I can tell, it's a Chow Yun-fat film. So it's his kind of.
There is that awesome.
Yes, exactly. So and he, you know, with the scenes aside, he is pretty awesome. But I think he's probably not a central bit.
He may be phoning it in a little.
Yeah, and he's done a million of these kind of swanky, erudite, god of gamblers style guys. You know, I'm just coming to the baccarat table and I'm going to win, not because I'm good at baccarat, because I have like gambling magic. You know, there's a lot of chip CGI. Yeah, a lot of cards flying around.
You can't see the gestures that go with
right,
that,
right.
This is audio.
So apparently, yeah, it's action, it's adventure, it's got FBI agents, it's got whatever the Chinese equivalent is of the
tax inspectors.
People we hope never to meet.
Yeah, and apparently it didn't do all that well. I mean, it did, I guess, well enough. $49 million US, and it's.
Can we connect this up to the, you know, the ongoing pressure on Macau from the anti-corruption drive?
Right, yeah.
Decided not only would we not go to Macau and spend money, we won't even go to the movie about Macau.
Right. Well, the first movie, as I understand it, was a really big send. It was back when Macau, which now, even with the, now that Macau has flattened out, Macau still generates 5 times as much in gaming receipts as all of Las Vegas.
I think it's anywhere else combined. I remember hearing at one point.
But and Las Vegas isn't even number 2 anymore. Yeah. Singapore is number 2.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and Singapore only has 2 casinos. And a shitload of Chinese Indonesians living very close by. So, you know,
well, this is also a traditional time of year for gambling.
Right.
And
but I think the last couple of years, the last couple of years were kind of a little bit of like a, you know, 2 fingers to Las Vegas. I mean, certainly the first one was like, yeah, man, we're really the gods of gambling now. And now the fact that they've got to throw in a lot of extra gunfightery and extra chip magic. So anyway, so there was that. Chow Yun-fat is kind of, he certainly doesn't need, he's not one of these sort of, he's not Nicolas Cage. He doesn't have tax problems where he has to, like, you know, I don't, not that I know of, but I mean, but you know, it seems unfair that he has to sort of phone in these types of roles, but I don't know.
He may be just perceived as the anchor of this mini genre.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. He is the god of gamblers,
and one of the kind of, you know, ongoing fallout from the way in which the Hong Kong film industry has shrunk is that after a certain point they really stopped producing leading men, and
right,
to a lesser extent, they even stopped producing leading women. So we kind of, it's a very,
this is
kind
turn
of
into
retrogressive
a fertility riff.
Oh God, I hope not. But, well, it would be nice if suddenly somebody new became glamorous.
Right,
it has that kind of that French chanson quality of everybody just gets older and older and older.
Right.
And some people are wearing it well, like Chow Yun-fat.
Yeah.
But there's a kind of general.
Well, that's a very good point. There aren't like a lot of new glamorous Hong Kong.
Well, this is because the industry was extremely synergistic. Everyone was a movie star, a recording star, and did these massive concerts. And
right,
when those pillars began to shake or crumble, it wasn't actually possible to build somebody up through this incredible machinery anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
So the stars are still there, but it's very much, you know, they're up in the sky.
Right.
The way to get there, you know, all the things that are being made more self-consciously as Hong Kong productions now are pretty indie, and they're not.
Yeah.
You know, they're in some fairly deliberate counterpoint to that aesthetic.
Got it. Now, well, I mean, not except for the other big film, which was 12 Golden Ducks.
Yes, but as you pointed out,
yes,
the star of this is the star of the first of the
Sandra Ng.
And these seem to be very much the carry on films of the Chinese New Year,
right? And for non Anglophiles, carry on.
Oh, is there an American equivalent?
I don't know.
Are they kind of like broad sex comedies? Is that where you're going with?
They're like broad, silly, kind of slightly saucy comedies.
Saucy.
They're not necessarily kind of sexual, but
right. Well, these are pretty. These are all pretty. They're all about prostitutes.
But there's a lot of innuendo, and
yeah,
they were made for the kind of internal British market. They were kind of a B picture, a B comedy in series that have lots of running gags across the film.
It's like you're going back to the 30s and a lot of the black and white films of the day.
And they're very much like the kind of review films. And that there's, you know, lots of characters who play lots of people who play characters with different names but are really the same person.
Right, right. Well, that's definitely this. I mean, this is the fourth.
Over and over again.
This is the fourth in this series, which Sandrine has starred in all of them. But in the first three, they're all about female prostitutes, and they're all about chickens because, and the Cantonese dialectical, I guess, pun is that chickens are sort of a slang term for female prostitutes. Ducks are more synonymous with, you know, boy toys or gigolos. Gigolos.
Gigolos. I like gigolo.
Starting gigolo. Sort of, you know, there's a little bit of insane con posse about it.
But right.
But also, you know.
Well, there's a whole lot of makeup being worn. I mean, again, this woman who's kind of franchised this out, she was the main character. She's managed to be the main character in all these movies, and you ask yourself, but wait, Ross, the first three were about female prostitutes, and this one's about male prostitutes. Well, apparently she's
versatile.
She's versatile. Well, there's kind of a Magic Mike element where there's a lot of like Chippendale. What did I say before? Chesapeake.
It's a mental picture. I think we just have to run with.
So there's
Chesapeake stripper.
Yeah. So there's a lot of male stripper action, and she's yeah.
Seersucker,
yeah. Now, this is more Gold LeMay ripoff pants ish, which Sandra Ng, apparently does, but with a one of those fake six pack torsos. She just basically has a fake body bolted onto her.
So she's going a sort of, you know, Eddie Murphy sort of route. Where she plays all the characters.
And okay, that's a bit of a stretch, but I'm with you. She does play all of the characters, but I mean, you got to admit that's pretty
prosthetics. Stupid. That's what I'm reaching for.
Right, it's prosthetic, but I think that's going to be the first time anyone's kind of gone the prosthetic, like male to female prosthetics, when you actually had to strip off, you know,
I feel like someone there's probably a challenge to that, but I feel
okay.
Like I'm not the person to answer it.
Listener challenge. Write in with your favorite...
Your prosthetic torso.
Your favorite male to
female...
Female to male prosthetic torso
and
action comedy.
Tilda Swinton...
Victor Victoria.
Does not count.
Right. Victor
nothing,
Victoria.
Nothing tastefully
Victor
filmed.
Victoria.
Was there a full frontal in that?
I don't remember. I saw it a long time ago.
I just think she was wearing, you know, she was wearing a tuxedo.
She was wearing a tuxedo for most of it.
Tuxedos don't count.
This is more a kind of, you know, see my chest.
Topless,
it's made
yes.
out of gorilla vest kind of thing.
Well, no, it's more like sort of, it's more like Leonidas in 300, you know, so that Spartan, like, sort of buff yet hairless. There's no... Yeah. Although, well, anyways. Okay. I think
we've
exhausted that.
For three people who have not seen it.
we have thought deeply about it.
Indeed.
So what do you guys do for Chinese New Year?
I and many mainland Chinese people, along with me, went to Australia, where the sun is shining and the air is clean and you can take a deep breath. It's delightful. I enjoyed it immensely.
Where'd you go?
I was in Perth, which is...
Oh, wow.
Lovely. And only 8 hours away. So that was nice.
And same time zone and everything, right?
Same time zone. I went to the Chinese New Year celebration for Perth.
Just because you couldn't get away.
I couldn't. And my friend insisted we get some dumplings, which were really, really bad. So I do not recommend eating dim sum
in
Australia as a side dish.
If everything was better in Australia, you probably would have stayed.
That's true. That is true. But it was lovely.
So so we have this image in our mind of Chinese tour groups when they come to Hong Kong is, well, obviously the demographics have shifted and people are less, it's less the kind of well-heeled, I will buy every Fendi bag I can see, and it's more sort of farmers from Anhui province following a red flag. So
yeah.
where along the socio-demographic trajectory are the mainland traveler, CNY travelers to Australia.
Yes, so the ones that I encountered were the moneyed sort. I was doing some retail damage myself, excited to be shopping in a place that catered to non-Asian sizes.
Okay.
Exciting. So there were lots of people. The Apple Store was mobbed. So
what was non-Asian sized about the Apple Store?
It was cheaper. We just wandered through.
The Australian dollar is kind of tanked over the day.
Yes, it has.
Now for a currency corner.
But you said you didn't want to talk about
that. No, I know. Okay. And so there are lots of money.
So when you go back through, if you are traveling to Australia, make sure you get back your GST, which is like 12% maybe.
Right.
And there, I was leaving at around 11 o'clock, so you had to call this telephone number and open your suitcase to a guy who was up in a window, and there were like 10 of us with all of our purchases, like, so he could see, like, yeah, I really bought this. I think by the time he got to me, he was like, I'm sure you bought all the clothes you said you bought. Go. I don't want to do this anymore. Because you're supposed to carry them with you. So
Do they make it hard to do it apart from that? Because in Singapore, what they don't tell you is you need to actually, when you buy something, you have to get a special form right then and there.
No, it's actually really easy. They even have an app so that you can fill out the stuff. Dude. And they, like, scan the app and then you're done. Ask you a couple of questions.
But there's still one bored guy at the airport that has to physically...
to examine the stuff.
Okay.
So, well, he didn't really examine mine. Everyone else. Mine, he was like, yeah, sure. You spent a ridiculous sum on clothes. Carry on.
You may have seen people returning from Perth
with many, many clothes.
Hong Kong, right. In this way before.
Right. Cool.
The air was slightly more breathable here than usual because, of course, there was much less traffic. And also because... the factories in Shenzhen presumably kind of shut up for at least 24 hours.
Yeah.
What I noticed, as you all heard last week, I had lost my voice. I had strep throat and an ear infection, which was my third in 4 weeks. And
right.
So I have been back for 24 hours, and on my way here, I purchased an air purifier. So hopefully that is going to help, because it is...
An Australian air purifier?
No, in Hong Kong, I purchased a fancy American... purifier of some sort.
We use ours in the house.
Yes,
and it may just be voodoo, but
I'm debating about that question.
But kind of filtering the air, drying the air with the humidifiers.
It is humid.
It's clammy.
It's starting to get clammy.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. I mean, well, yeah, the whole dehumidifier thing. I mean. When I grew up with a humidifier, and in the wintertime, it often had sort of dollops of Vicks Vapor Rub or something in it because I was a croupy child. You know, I should have sworn to Dickinsonian greats because I'm one of those children of disease and pent-up winters. But this winter, this Chinese New Year, we were in our village, a small fishing village in Lantau, which really very few people who actually are from this village are there all year long. But in Chinese New Year, of course, everybody comes back, and they bring a million kids. The median age in my village when it's not Chinese New Year is like 78. But the sons and daughters and the grandsons all come back. And so this is where, to your earlier question, this is where you have to get your red packet game on. So in Chinese New Year, during Chinese New Year, you typically, depending on where you are in life and in marital status, you are either a net giver or a net receiver of red packets. Now, kids...
Lycee,
yeah. Now, kids are usually net receivers, and my children who are... culturally non-responsive to anything Chinese except the receipt of red packets, you know, perk up as if it were Christmas morning on Chinese New Year and skedaddle out into the village just so old people can see and acknowledge them as children and therefore pay them for the privilege of being children. But you yourself have to carry around, you have to kind of go with a big stack. You don't have to put a lot in, $20 Hong Kong, so about $3 US. But you do have to kind of make sure that everybody within sight who is a child...
And the city has had a multi-year campaign in terms of waste management around this about trying to encourage people to not go to the bank and get all of the money new.
Mm.
Ah.
Because this is actually... it's so... enormous is the impulse to do this, that it actually has an environmental cost. So
the bills themselves, and not just the fact that people rip up red packets and chuck them into the streets.
Yes, just the whole transaction, and indeed kind of fresh packaging on lots of things.
Right.
So various means and ways are instituted to try and reduce the impact of this and introduce recycling for various, you know, parts of the New Year's gifts and packets that are exchanged.
Well, my favorite form is to just forget about it until the very last minute and then run around the house scraping together every last crinkly dollar in every pocket that you have.
Well, apparently you're on trend this year.
I am. So the baseline is, if you're married and if you have kids, you are obviously a net distributor. And if you're not married,
people who are married
give to you. Right.
Yes.
And people who are older give to people who are younger.
Unless they're married.
Unless they're married.
Unless they're both married, then it's a wash.
What gets complicated is when it's people who do stuff for you. So do you give to your doorman? What if you have six doormen? Do you give to your helper? Even if you gave her a Christmas bonus, do you give to your secretary, even though she's married and you're not? Like,
I think the answer to all those are probably yes, unfortunately.
In governmental organizations and universities and schools, this and Lycee actually come under the anti-corruption, anti-bribery legislation. Mm. So you are
for any amount? Okay.
I'm making an equivocal gesture here. It's really not clear. Because you can be seen to be seeking favor through the distribution of this. So effectively,
which you are doing anyways.
Yes, well, on the one hand, this is kind of officially banned. So people then need to find ways to give, particularly, you know, the ladies in the office.
Right.
Gifts for New Year's that are not New Year's gifts. So
is that
various
oranges instead of something
usually,
else.
Usually fancy biscuits.
Lettuce.
Fancy biscuits and something red.
Yeah,
and
lettuce is not really a gift.
We have a dragon coming.
Right. Unless you're a dragon, I'm sorry. Yes.
And we are giving it lettuce.
Right. But you know what's in the lettuce? You know what's in the lettuce?
No.
A Lycee packet.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Because
we were told to leave our Lycee packets on the desk and it would go around and collect them. And in addition, we were going to have lettuce to give to it.
Right. So here's the other thing. And this I know because
lettuce, because it's like money for those. It's because it's green, I assume. Or because it grows fast. I don't know.
I think it isn't green.
Well, not here. I think that there are analogs. But the other reason you give lettuce to the dragon, and this I know again from village life, is that in the rural parts of Hong Kong, these dragon or lion dancers will go around kind of village to village, and they'll do the house blessings. And what you do is you tie a lettuce to a bamboo pole, and then you stuff the packets in it, and you hang it from the second floor.
And these lettuces are usually conical.
Yeah, yeah. One year I did a Boston bib lettuce and was roundly told off. So no Boston bib lettuce.
We saw a video when we did the blessing for office last year, and someone had a video
appropriate
of an office
lettuce distribution.
It was sort of like this one, and up here we have that sort of pressed. What is this stuff called? Where there's like the metal framework and then essentially soft particle board in between the metal framework, and they'd hung the lettuce, and the eager dragon brought down the ceiling. It was amazing.
Especially blessing.
Well, see, one of the main reasons that you're supposed to be kind of giving the, and I'm sorry, I'm fuddling for some
lettuce information.
Some lettuce specific information. Oh, it's on the other phone. Is that what the dragon dancers do if they're really good? Is, you know, they dance with the lion dancers dance with their big old head, and they go up and they snatch the lettuce, and hopefully not the ceiling with it. But then they deftly extract the money bits out of it and spit out the lettuce in like this big showering thing in front of your door. And that's supposed to be the blessing, is the
they take a little money and then give you a lot of symbolic wealth.
Yeah. So that when the bigger the vomitous spray of lettuce on your door, the better your year will be. Hmm. So I'm going to have a really, really good year.
It's interesting from the perspective of a religious background that is very agriculturally based, right? So there isn't that same. This is a religious or a, I don't know what to call it. It's not religious precisely, but a religious tradition that feels much more urban in its thought processes and structure somehow.
Except when you get to the lettuce vomiting.
Yeah, but even that, I mean, if the lettuce is representative of some sort of money as opposed to lettuce, right?
Like, you know,
sort of interesting.
Well, Levi Strauss would say it's both lettuce and money, and you can't distinguish between the two.
And it's occasionally the lettuce is cooked, but
I was thinking about this recently. I spent some time for Chinese New Year in Australia with my goddaughter, who is 3. Who wanted me to explain why lion dancing, why were people giving each other oranges, which is very difficult to do to a 3-year-old.
Right.
So I was trying to come up with analogs to her life and was sort of struggling with it a little bit.
Well, gold means gold, and money means money. I mean, this is the...
those are the edicts by which you rule your life.
And then there are parts of Chinese folk religion which are...
Yeah, a lot of it's pun related. I mean, a lot of the fish imagery is because the word for fish is very similar to the word for fortune, or rather, they're homonyms.
But it can be crossed with different kinds of symbolism. So you have the fish, which is a pun for surplus, and then, but you have to be careful to keep its head and its head and the tail intact, so that the year is good at the beginning and at the end. Mm. And then the head faces the most honored person at the dinner. So these symbols can be turned.
Now, I stand by my assertion that I find it to be a much more hierarchical and urban sort of way of dealing and thinking about the world. And I don't actually think this is bad. I just think it's different when you're approaching it and you're trying to understand it because you're my frame.
Because you're a country girl at heart?
I'm a country girl at heart. No, the symbolism that we use and the language that we use is very different.
Mm. Although there's an additional wrinkle to the whole fish thing, which is very southern Chinese, which is also very maritime, is that you're not supposed to ever, and this is not just during Chinese New Year, this is just whenever you're eating fish, you're not ever supposed to flip the head of the fish. So you sever the head. If you have a whole fish and you finish eating the one side, you sever the head from the body and flip the body. You never flip the head itself because that's like flipping the boat. So that's one point against your urban sophisticate argument.
It's a more advanced culture to have boats.
You're right. Actually, it's not flipping the yacht. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
So when you weren't fighting mainland shoppers for the bargains of Western Australia, what have you been consuming of a non-material nature?
So I am, as I think I said last time, on a kick of reading things that are Chinese-inspired or Chinese Asian, because I did not know a lot about it before I came, as I think I mentioned. So I am right now reading two books by someone whose name I am not going to be able to pronounce, but the writer, one of the books is called Scale Bright, and they're based on sort of Chinese folktales.
Mm-hmm.
And I just had the name come up. I can't pronounce that at all. The Archer Who Shot Down the Sun and Scale Bright. And it's interesting. Scale Bright is about a sort of a retelling of a Chinese folktale about the woman who lived in the moon and the archer who shot down the sun as lesbian lovers. And it's set in a modern Hong Kong. And it's one of those moments when you recognize the city as you are reading about it, which is distinct, I think, from recognizing a city that you're watching on a screen.
Right.
There is something, for me, that has always been a little bit more personal about reading the scene as opposed to watching it for whatever reason. So
would it fall into this category that is now being called urban fantasy?
It would indeed, which is a conversation that we had recently in another context. So they are urban fantasy about Hong Kong.
I think the author is Thai.
Yes, that might be. I don't know. Benjamin something.
It's also a... It's a
hey, that's
also,
all
it's
kinds of crazy tie. Name. Yeah. Ben... Yeah, I'm gonna... But
and she is someone who has a presence on the...
Yes, there are some... She has some controversial presence on the internet, I think it's fair to say. But I did not know that when I started reading the books. And I am going to continue to not... I don't really want to do that particular.
Okay.
It's controversial. But... They are very good.
Key phrases.
I recommend them. Troll.
Okay.
So
troll and pseudonymous troll.
Okay.
Yes.
So her nymous. My shot at this is Benjamin Sri Duan Kayo.
I'm also reading The Emperor Far Away, which is about a journalist traveling at the edge of the Chinese Empire and talking to people about what their experiences of being Uyghur. Underneath Han Chinese rule, etc., etc., and it is very interesting and very readable.
And Year of the Goat appropriate.
So I recommend both of those things as I continue to learn about
goat.
In most of China, the meat of first resort is pork,
but in the
Uyghur areas, it is very much mutton, lamb, goat.
No, I've.
They probably have more words for it.
Well, and you're going to pull that Eskimo snow-ness on me?
That one has been problematized.
Right.
I'm pretty sure that the people who heard these things have different words for them.
Well, I've been to Xinjiang a number of times, and yes.
Why?
Well, the first time...
Part of what I'm getting from this book is nobody goes there.
Oh, it's amazing. I mean, it's all... remember Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon? You know, that middle bit that was all filmed out in Xinjiang. I mean, it's just mad, crazy deserts. You know, camels running around everywhere.
Awesome.
Lots of, people sitting, drinking tea and playing, like, electric guitars.
I remember that bit from Crouching Tiger.
No, that part's not... But what I'm saying, it's got a very sort of, we're on the edge of... civilization vibe, very hard but friendly type people. Mm. Well, the first time I was traveling with a friend over the Karakoram Highway and trying to get into Kyrgyzstan. The only way you could get from Kyrgyzstan to Pakistan was through.
Got it.
China. The second time, my wife read a couple of books and said, "We got to go check this out. Let's do it." But yes, very lamb intensive, right to the point where the thing that you get in most restaurants as like a you know how you go to a Chinese restaurant, usually there's two or three sort of condiment-y type things, which if they're bastards about it, they'll charge you for. So there's like the peanuts and there's some kimchi-ish type thing. The equivalent in a restaurant in Xinjiang is just a big bowl of cubes of mutton fat. Just the fat.
Just snacking
gelatinous mutton fat. Yeah.
That does not... Oh, and on a complete change of subject, I'm also continuing the three-body problem.
Yeah, I want to hear about that. You're halfway through, you said.
Yeah, so I'm about halfway through. It's an interesting story and premise. I cannot decide whether it's the writing that's sort of making it very slow going for me to sort of submerse myself in this world, or whether it's the translation, because you can never tell in a translated document where the clunky... There's a little bit of a clunky factor here.
And very science-y?
Right now, it's still mysterious. There's a video game reality that people are going in and out of that they talk about a little bit, and I am glossing over those parts a tad. But it is worth reading. It is interesting. There are two more books in this series that have not been translated into English yet, I do not believe, or at least have not been released. So I have some time to get through this book.
So what's if you had to sort of
summarize it?
Well, no. Where I was going was, if you had to sort of say, okay, this is, because to my great shame, I don't think I've ever actually read a Chinese science fiction novel end to end. But if you had to sort of say, this is what I'd consider to be the key difference in approach or kind of premise, what strikes you as being most different about this what sounds to me from what you've described is kind of like a Chinese version of Snow Crash, or some, there's cyberpunky elements and some hard science elements, but is there anything that you've never encountered before, or a premise that you find very different from all the other science fiction you've read?
I think that I haven't found anything that's completely different from anything else I've read yet, but I'm not all the way through. What I am finding is it's a little square in its language. It feels a little bit like it was written in, like, 1950-ish, which, again, is sort of that question of translation versus
right.
language. I'm having a hard time hearing it in my head, if you know what I mean.
So it's set in modern times, but they're all talking, like, Archie and Jughead.
It's just very stilted. Maybe that's the right word for it.
Okay.
Some of the dialogue. I know I'm really selling this book, but
and we're selling it kind of quite slowly.
Join us again next month. We will be 75% through of the three-body problem.
I'm flying home. You finish everything.
Mr. Alice is 15 pages in where you.
Oh right. Okay.
So,
okay.
And I think he's kind of stuck there.
Yeah.
Wow. This is, you know.
And he's a he's a machine.
It's true. You know, but with your most Thomas Pynchon novels, there's a kind of terrible wall at about 50 pages, and if you make it past that, you'll go straight to the end. But the wall for the three body problem seems to be about 15 pages in.
I have gotten farther than that.
Right.
So you have scaled.
I like the premise. Like, I find the premise interesting, and I want to know how he solves it. Sometimes what I do if I'm sort of stuck in a book is I go and read the last, like, 30 pages, and then I say to myself, okay, I might not totally understand what happened, but I've got an idea of how it ended. Do I care how they got there? And if the answer is not at all, I just wanted to know where how it ended, then I stop, but I haven't quite gotten to that point at this point.
Ah, that's an interesting lifeline. I just give up at something. Although, I confess, I did something I've never, ever, ever done before. I hate read a book all the way through it, only because it's a book that I think, well, all of us in our...
It was 50 Shades of Grey, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. All three of them. Just marathon that stuff.
150 Shades of Grey?
It's almost a gross of Shades of Grey. No, it was... And I think you're going to reach across the mic and punch me for hating on this, but it was The Name of the Wind.
Oh, you didn't like it.
I didn't like it, and I really, really, really didn't like it. And the reason I hate read it to the end is because
so many people really like
you,
it.
Yeah, you and many of the people that we regularly commune, know in common, have kind of really sold me, and to the extent that
what didn't you like?
Okay, I dislike the fact that...
For the sake of this podcast, say the name and
okay.
the title and the author.
Okay, so the name of the Wind, Patrick
Rothfuss,
yeah. Which is the genre bind it, high fantasy...
a little bit of a steampunk element, I would say.
A teensy...
It's not a pure, like...
Teensy bit.
Elves and swords and stuff.
No, but this is, yes... however, you've actually sort of opened
you thought there should be more elves and swords.
No, no. I was actually okay with the fact that he's drip feeding you. Okay, so let me back up. I mean, I'm sure many people have kind of gotten into this, but it's in the universe of people who are listening to or have talked about, everyone seems to be sort of into this. Two books into this three-book trilogy.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. And it's got kind of your standard elements, you know, a world which is broadly middle-earthy, middle-agey. There's magic, but there's a somewhat interesting twist on magic, which you alluded to, sort of steampunk in that it's not sort of super incomprehensible magic. It's like magic, which is science. It's called sympathy magic or sympathy where, you know, you can set things on fire if they're flammable to begin with, or things, elements that have chemist. The guy studied chemical engineering at one stage, and so that kind of comes very clearly sort of...
I don't really like to know about the authors of the things.
I'm sorry, man.
That's okay. it's always interesting when people tell me, because it's like, I sort of knew about the troll thing, and then I'm like, yeah, I don't need to know that. Yeah.
Have you ever read any E.E. Doc Smith?
No.
He is a kind of science fiction writer of the Golden Age, very much kind of... He'll take the rocket. And
Doc Savage, right?
And they have a... can't remember if he actually... But they're all these kinds of, you know, mission into space.
Right.
And they're full of, you know, it's the source of a lot of kind of the language of science as used in space opera.
Right.
The kind of death ray stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's Doc because he has a doctorate in science.
Right.
Turns out what his actual specialism was in...
space science.
Donut science.
Donut science.
What's that? You know, he was in...
Of, like, the donuts that we had just a few minutes ago?
These would be rather advanced.
Okay.
Doc Smith.
That would be kind of awesome.
But this was, you know, so he got from, you know, like, basically kind of temperature chemistry for frying foodstuffs out to, you know, death ray from Mars, Skylark of space,
okay,
kind of stuff. And...
Okay.
It's just a reminder that you know, whatever your scientific background, it's never too late to turn it into interstellar.
Right, got it.
Yes,
I think he was the Doc Savage guy or one of the. Anyways, certainly that era. So
yes.
So back to our regular scheduled hate
yes.
read. The main thing about it is that it's a freaking long ass book, which I usually don't mind, except that nothing happens over it. He spends enormous amount of time and being kind of
coy
and Batman-y sad about his parents being dead and cooking up this long, slow, laborious plan to kind of think about figuring out who killed his parents. But he keeps getting sidetracked about money problems.
Girls,
but he has no experience with girls. This is probably the biggest problem I had with it, is that he clearly is... there was a clear amount of wish fulfillment in that, like, he's this I always mess up that word. Help me out.
Ingenue?
Thank you.
How did I do?
Yes, but you can't use it again with men, can you?
No.
Oh, damn. What's a male ingenue?
Oh,
a duck.
No. Yeah, a duck. A duck. Or possibly a sheep.
All right. So he's this, I don't know. I'm a master lutist and I'm...
The juvenile lead.
Yeah. He's super good at everything he touches.
Yes.
Except women. But all the women are stone cold foxes who are super into him regardless. And just goes on and on. And he never kisses any of them. And... he just, you know, is always better than his rivals at playing the lute and, like, bringing them over to his favor.
Maybe you do need to read Fifty Shades of
Grey. I think my head would explode.
Because, see, I don't think he's any good at the lute.
It's not that I want him... I don't want this... it all sex bomb out. I mean, I don't want, like, Tarnsmen of Gore style, like, stuff. But at least stuff happens in, like, more sort of lurid... It's because he's so into his own... He's, like, a completely unlikable character to me. And again, that doesn't disqualify him from me liking the book overall. Have you ever read Michael Moorcock's Colonel Piatt trilogy? Okay. He's got this long series of books where there's this set about the remnants, what am I trying to say here? The told from the perspective of a very old, curmudgeonly Ukrainian emigre to London in the swinging 60s, who's clearly Jewish, but is very anti-Semitic and completely convinced he's not Jewish and he is this horrible racist and this horrible sort of self-denier and loather. But because it's very clear, because of the world around him sees him for what it is, and that sort of switches into things that you can kind of get with his... You almost root for him. He's a horrible person, but because he's so
it's like watching The Vampire Diaries.
Yeah,
like, carry on.
Yeah, but in The Name of the Wind, there's no check against him. He's just this super dude, and anything that he hasn't been super at yet, you know he will be, and yet for all his superness, nothing really happens for 1,000 pages. That's my main issue with it.
I feel like I had very similar reactions to Game of Thrones, but I'm not sure I could explain them so cogently.
Although, I guess maybe that would be the answer
the two big series that people are reading.
Yeah.
I know people who love them both, but I loathed everything about Game of Thrones, and I tried multiple times because so many people that I respected before were like, how can you not be reading them?
Yeah.
And I just hated it.
I mean, yeah, I now feel
very pleased with my decision just to go with the television program now that everybody else is getting really bitter.
I never got through the first book, so I don't have any entitlement to feel bitter, but give me Penny Dreadful every time over
that. It's coming back.
Over that.
It's
Thank
coming
goodness.
Back.
Thank goodness. Yeah, we switched to this television
program. No, that's fine. I just... something about Josh Harnett's mustache, man.
But it's all so ridiculous. Like, everything about
that show... That is a ridiculous stash.
It's completely ridiculous.
And it's played so straight.
Yeah.
I know. The Eva Green possession scene, no way was that played straight.
Well, there's a kind of...
Dorian Gray is not played straight on several levels, but...
No, I don't...
But not bummed.
I don't mean straight like that.
Yes, no.
always forward. But it's a kind of remarkably... It's kind of... They're doing the tropes very straight. Mm. It's been very carefully collaged together, and various strands have been brought together in it. But they're not, kind of undermining the basic symbolism. And it is, even whether it works or not, is sometimes in question. But it is actually supposed to be scary.
So let me ask you this:
different
as someone who read and loved all the Alan Moore's League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, and thought that the movie was just this ignominious abomination. Would this kind of be my methadone fix for seeing the League of?
I think methadone is the right thing because it's not. it both lacks and benefits in some cases from the lack of Alan Moore's kind of extra meta-ness.
Right.
The sense that somehow the kind of this stuff has to turn on itself and subvert itself. And that's
it's not all related to the Masons.
No, basically you have if they're telling you it's a conspiracy involving lots of vampires, it's a conspiracy involving lots of vampires.
And not Masons.
Everybody
vampires.
Has secrets, but the secrets are usually,
I
killed a man.
Okay.
A lot of men.
That one,
or everyone.
I'm
a vampire. And I'm Dorian Gray, and
I have tuberculosis.
Oh.
Yeah, and they're really, really...
A lot of lungers?
It's lung-tastic.
Yeah.
It's lung-tastic.
and
there are artfully displayed coughs with artfully displayed cough.
Do you know...
They've really kind of tried to pursue that 19th century fetishization of consumption and TB, and
played by Rose from The Doctor.
Okay,
she's also coming back.
So you're both saying for it's an acceptable methadone clinic for
yes,
and they really sell close to the wind since
okay.
In terms of how close to League of Extraordinary Gentlemen does it get? Really close.
Really close. Yeah. Okay.
I assume that basically the fact that Alan Moore just went did a kind of giant hands off. I'm never going.
Well, he's never accepted any filmed version of any of his properties, right?
Terrible.
Yeah. Well. But before they even he just knew that they were going to be terrible.
V's for Vendetta is not an awful, awful film. It's not a good adaptation.
I think I fell asleep while trying to watch it, which might sometimes is a reflection of the film and sometimes it's a reflection of how tired I am, to be fair.
I saw it in Italy, where the title is translated as Vu per Vendetta.
Okay.
It was pretty good in Italian.
Right.
Actually, especially action movies.
It's interesting.
Because the clunky dialogue just sounds great when you shout it in Italian. Suddenly it's like Verdi.
Okay, I'm not... For whatever reason, I found myself watching a Italian-dubbed version of Faster Pussycat Kill Kill dubbed on YouTube. And I don't know if you're familiar with Russ Meyer's Uvar.
Bien sûr.
Bien sûr. So there is this within.
Ma certo.
Within this, there is a non-Italian actor who is playing one of the three sort of busty go-go dancer murderesses. Is supposed to be an Italian, and she does all the sort of, you know, hand gestures and has a really bad Italian accent and gesticulates in with kind of faux Italian phrases, but then. When she gets dubbed over into Italian, it kind of has this sort of...
Do they try to do her in a bad accent?
No, well, okay, what do I know?
Or do they try to do her as a German playing in Italian?
I speak no Italian. You know,
no bones back.
I was doing some spreadsheeting at the same time, and sort of, you know, that's sort of what I have in the corner.
Faster
when
Faster XL.
It just helped the spreadsheets go by. So I... All I know is that, yes, it did make... The overall dubbing did make the filmic experience better, but there was an added layer of irony when it all settled on the faux Italian member of the posse. And that sort of was a long, circuitous way around everything. You've told us about what you have broadly... been watching, but what is there anything particular that you want to bring to the fore, Alice?
just say I did go to the fireworks for Chinese New Year.
Nice.
Okay.
Which, as in most years except the Year of the Dragon, is really more ordnance that you see being blown up. In the Year of the Dragon, they just... blew stuff up.
Right.
It was like 45 minutes.
We own this place.
45 minutes of just stuff going bang.
Right.
At an incredible rate.
So in the Year of the Sheep, it was much more subdued.
The Year of the Sheep was a little bit more subdued. They've been working at
harmonious
fireworks.
In the last couple of fireworks displays, they've been doing... they've got a technology now where they put up good luck symbols, number 8, rings,
cool
characters. So that's, and that I have to say, I and the toddler were pretty impressed by this.
Okay.
And so that was a kind of particular New Year's thing.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, sort of following on the toddler theme, we watched Toy Story again for the... first time in many, many years, and had caused that to think about CGI, where it's come from, where it's gone. I was in, and was very impressed once again. Some of the CGI in which we were watching in high definition, which was maybe a little much.
3 inches from the screen.
But the CGI was some of it was. Worked really well.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the human characters look terrible now.
Right.
And you know, lots of people have approached that problem. They hadn't really learned to do fur at that point, but just the kind of the sheer smartness of deciding what are we able to do with this technology? How about some badly molded toy soldiers?
Right, right.
And the decisions that were made, which are decisions of art direction as much as technology.
Right.
And you know, now that, at least for the moment, because these things are always shifting, but now that people feel they can do anything with digital, they are not making as smart decisions. And the constraint that was still present, and the smartness of what they decide to animate and how they decide to animate it, as well as kind of some fun, I mean, that everybody knows as, you know, if you're watching children's films, that Toy Story is just a gift that gives and gives the whole series because they're so full of detail and clever things.
And heart.
But just, you know, there's a whole kind of Island of Dr. Moreau sequence, which, you know, no one, you know, thinks of for four films later, but there, you know, there it is with all of these kind of mangled toys. It's really bleak. But just that kind of, the kind of curatorial eye that they were applying when there was actually choices to be made about what could be convincingly animated and what couldn't. And, you know, now that so
anything
much more is possible. And, you know, whenever you're looking at the effects of the films of the past, you know, if you look at the first Jurassic Park or, you know, Ray Harryhausen. You're always, you know, going back to something that looked incredibly convincing at the time, but was in fact another period way of seeing. But people still tend to think of these effects as invisible. And what struck me about, is interesting about Toy Story is they really continued to get away with a lot because they made very good decisions.
Yeah. I mean, it's a good point. My kids are kind of beyond that stage, so I haven't sort of hit that, I haven't kind of reached back into the vault for a while, and I haven't watched anything that sort of good and deep, ironically, because the kids are older and thus think that's kind of below them. But I had...
You have to get back to your 40s.
Yeah. But I watched The Box Trolls with them recently, which is kind of... It's a little borderline, and it's very claymation-y. I mean, it is, I think it is claymation or whatever that kind of...
Yes, Wallace and Gromit.
Yes, it's very Wallace and Gromit-y. But I think...
Is it actually stop motion or is it...
It is. In fact, they kind of make a big deal of it in the credits where they have this actually fairly amazing scene where they superimpose the actors... well, not the actors, the sculptors kind of making the finite moves while everything's moving in real time. So these sort of ghost-like sculptors are kind of moving in and out. And so you're very... the movie makes you conscious of the fact that it isn't just CGI. And yet, it was so super over the top. And I don't know if it was because they felt the need to be overcompensating for the fact that, as you say, now in CGI... You can animate cards and chips and things from Vegas to Macau and back again. But so I found it a little bit overwhelming and underwhelming at the same time.
The aesthetic nadir of watching Toy Story was the blurb from Apple TV, which said, "In a world where toys come to life," which struck me as like what everybody's world of being a child? Where does that not happen? And I just thought the idea that they had
in a world where you are not soul dead.
The old man from Up, that's what you're becoming.
Right.
So,
No, I do like stuff. I just haven't liked anything the past week.
Recently.
Yeah, I know.
You need a really fat Boy Scout to come and find your heart
with a dog who keeps saying squirrel. That might be my favorite Pixar movie, so.
My dog just tore his ACL.
Oh.
After my son just tore his ACL.
That's devotion. Stupid, but devotion.
Right, exactly. Yeah, he's reincarnated sort of dog from Egypt time, sort of, you know, he was going to throw himself on a funeral pyre, but oh, you just tore your ACL, fine. I'll go ahead and do that, but. Anyway, sorry to end this on a low note, but I promise next episode I will like something. I'll like it.
And I'm hoping to read a book again.
Okay, yeah, all right.
Might happen.
And you will read 25 to 30% more of a book.
So my goal this year is to read 250 books, so I need to read...
Dag nabbit!
Another.
All right, then we're going to clock you in. If we're doing this in 3 weeks... quick math, that's, you know, that's about four.
We could have a kind of, you know, one of those, a kind of...
thermometers.
Yeah.
Okay.
So,
an interactive feature.
I really want to finish the Taylor Branch, Martin Luther King Jr., by the next time we talk, the first of the three books, which are each 1,000 pages, and like The Name of the Wind... Well, actually, unlike The Name of the Week, quite a bit happens.
A coy lutist doesn't do shit for 1,000 pages.
Martin Luther King starts playing the lute. I wandered into the wrong book. But or maybe LBJ could play the lute. Anyway.
Right.
Taking it in a banjo, surely.
Right. Until next time, when we're well into the year of the...
Goat.
No, we're going with the goat. We're goating it up here.
Mongolia apparently has a blue ram, which I actually thought was cool. A blue.
Is it specifically his year?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So there was an NPR article for those who have not heard enough about this topic. I know you're out there. There was an NPR article about the different places and why they chose what they chose and the historical implications, and I sort of skimmed it while I was flying back from China,
trying to crank down three science fiction novels simultaneously.
While watching some Oscar nominated movies. Yeah. Yes.
Remember, it will be 12 years before we get to obsess about sheep and goat again. So
you might as well enjoy.
All right. Just live it up. All right. From the 60th floor of the 27th tallest building in the world, we are dystopian present, and we are out.
I persevered
because everybody...
I had stopped doing that. I really... It's very rare that I continue a book, but I...